Good morning. That was really loud. I'm really loud anyway. My name's Kevin Sprinkle. I'm the campus pastor at the North Campus. I don't know what you guys were expecting. You might have been expecting Chris Duncan today. Well, here's what you get. I'm better looking, but he's way smarter. So it's kind of a, you get that trade-off in here. Hey, I want to welcome everybody to the room today. Everybody here at South Campus, I want to welcome you. I want to welcome everybody at Crossroads North Campus, back across town, north side. We do have gang signs, so I'm going to flash that gang sign. And I want to welcome all you guys that are online today. I'm super excited to be here today. This is a great honor and privilege to be with you guys today. Hey, I like to cook. I like to cook. I cook for myself. I like to cook for other people. I think I cook a lot of things well. I think that I cook most things pretty well. But I got a couple things that I specialize in. One of the things I specialize in is bread pudding. Who's ever had bread pudding? Yeah. Who thinks they don't like bread pudding? You never had my bread pudding. Rob never had my bread pudding. When I make bread pudding, I use lots and lots of ingredients. When I do it, I use good bread and I tear that bread up. I use heavy whipping cream. I use milk. I use vanilla. I use almond extract. I chop up walnuts. I chop up dried cranberries. I use lots of sugar and things. I like to do lots and lots of things. When I get done, I cover the whole thing with a salted caramel sauce. I do that because I like all the flavors and all the richness of flavors. One of the other things that I'm really specialized in is meatballs. I make terrific meatballs. They're homemade meatballs and red sauce. I start from scratch. These aren't the little Sam's Club thing you buy frozen. These are big four-meat meatballs that have that are about the size of a baseball. And when I do it, I add, you know, ground veal, and I add ground pork, and ground sausage, and I use bacon in the meatballs. Why would that not be good, right? I use bacon in there. I use panko breadcrumbs. I use things like fresh rosemary, fresh basil. I use fresh garlic, and I cut garlic and mince it up. I use fresh onions. I cook all that stuff, and I put it all together. I do that not to try to get you guys ready for lunch, although this is sponsored by Olive Garden, by the way. But I do that because what I tell you is when we add lots more ingredients, lots more pieces in our life, lots more flavors, our life is a lot more full. I think our life becomes full when we add lots more flavors in that. We're going to talk today about relationships. And how I believe that through relationships of outside of our own sphere like that, how that adds those extra flavors, and they make things so much better as a result of that. We're gonna walk through the book of Ephesians. This series we're doing now is called God's Game Plan. It's a walk through Ephesians. And what we're doing is we're taking the book of Ephesians and we're talking about how that these things were written so long ago can be applied to a game plan in our lives today. I know last week Luke spoke here about unity. I spoke at the North Campus about unity. And I think that we all agree that unity is a good thing. We all agree that we should be unified in things. And I think we agree with that. Today, I want to kind of walk through about how some ways that we can get that unity. I think when we say that unity is a good thing, how do we actually get that unity? How do we really come together with that? Today, one of the things that we're going to talk about with the relationships is really part of one of our core values. It's core value number 5 when it comes at Crossroads, and it's we become more like Jesus together. We believe that when we're together in relationships and we get together in a lot of different ways, we become more like Jesus. We get, you know, the verse we use to reference that is Matthew 28:19-20. We're not meant to live life of faith alone, period. We could stop there. We cannot fully develop into who Jesus wants us to be by ourselves. We believe spiritual growth best happens in a group where we can encourage and challenge one another. I really believe that. I believe in our life, just like all those ingredients and all those wonderful things that we eat, that we are better together. And when we add those things and different pieces together, we are much better. And all those different unique flavors, we are better together. So we're going to walk through Ephesians. We're on chapter 4 this week. And chapter 4 chapter 4 at the heading of my Bible says unity in the body. Chapters 2 and chapter 3 also talked about unity. So this is a continuation of unity in the body. So I'm going to start with verse 1, chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore I, a prisoner for serving the Lord, Paul's writing this, and actually he was a prisoner at the time. The letter he wrote to the church in Ephesus, he was in prison when he wrote that. Beg you to lead a life worthy of your calling, for you have been called by God. In this case, I believe that the word calling and called actually means an invitation. more so than a particular calling where it's a particular ministry of things. If you read it like this, therefore I, a prisoner for serving the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of your invitation. For you have been invited by God. When we think about that, when we think about the invitation and that God gives us, and we think about that, that God's invited us to be a part of this, we think about that, how do we live a life that's worthy of that invitation? And I think one of the ways we can do that is through relationships, through connecting with people, through connecting with people, not just in our church body, but outside of our church body. I got thinking about this week, and I think there are two things that really that affect our relationships the most. Two things that affect us the most. One is we believe the wrong things. Our overall, our theology, our beliefs, or our thinks, the things that really shape who we are, we believe the wrong things to begin with. I think the second thing is we don't act consistently with our right beliefs. So in some cases, I think that we believe the wrong things. Our mindset, our theology, our beliefs about relationships are skewed. In other kinds, I think that we actually get it. We actually know the right beliefs. Our behaviors just don't act in accordance with those things. So if that's the case, we start out and say, is the issue a belief problem? Is it a belief problem to begin with? Is our problem with relationships and how we relate to others, is it a belief problem? Ephesians 4:4-6 says, for there is one body and one spirit, just as you've been called to one glorious hope for the future. There is one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all, in all, and living through all. See, the biggest problem that we have is we don't think the right things about each other. We don't go back and understand this unity part. We haven't adjusted our thinking, and so we really haven't arrived at who we are. As a result, we tend to see other people based upon our likes and our annoyances rather than how God sees them, because our beliefs are wrong. So we're going to talk a little bit about what some of our mistaken beliefs are. What are our beliefs that are really mistaken and out of here? One of the most common beliefs that we have that's wrong is that we can remain independent. We believe that that we can come to church and not be intermeshed and not be connected with other people here. We think we're an island. We think, hey, listen, I've got my time. I'm going to have my time with God. I've got my own personal time with God. And I'm encouraging you to do that. You should have your own personal time with God. But God didn't really, he's not blessing churches, and he's not really creating these churches and growing churches so that we can all come individually and all sit here and all have our own private time with God. He wants us to do that outside of here, but he wants us to become intermeshed with each other. He wants us to do it here at church. He wants us to do it in our neighborhoods. He wants to do that in our jobs. He wants to do it in our hobbies. He says, I want you to be together in unity. You weren't meant to do this alone. If you don't think that church is the place where you start having relationships and where you start having these connections, then we're kind of missing the big picture. We're missing the big picture. We go back to that core value of we become more like Jesus alone. We start right here, because if we can't have relationships, if we can't get along, if we can't be connected in a church, how are we ever going to do that outside of church? How are we ever going to do that when people look at us and go, y'all can't even get along at church? Why would I want to be a part of that? So a belief problem, how that we believe things and how that we see things. The other belief problem that I think is a problem that we have is that it has more to do with that we think we can choose who we love. We think we can choose who we love, because some people even say, man, that person is hard to love. I probably wouldn't love that person because of maybe how they look, how their hair is, maybe how they dress, what kind of music they listen to, the length of their hair, their age, or some other reason. But we think we can choose who we love. You know, sometimes we even think it's a secondary issue of because of their doctrine. If they think something a little bit different than us, we really can't really love those. The subtle way this happens and the way this really goes down is that we tend to gravitate to people who are like us. So what happens is because we've included more people like that, we have really intentionally excluded other people because it's easier. When this happens in an entire church, pretty soon everybody is just like us. And if that's the case, it's really easy to have unity, right? If everybody was just like you, unity is an easy thing. You know, years ago, I used to play in a lot of Gus Macker basketball tournaments. And for any of y'all thinking, yeah, right, just keep that to yourself. I used to play in a lot of basketball tournaments. I'd be in the senior division if I played now. But I played a lot of tournaments. And one time over in Lafayette, we played in a basketball tournament. It was a 3-on-3 basketball tournament. And me and the two other guys I played with, we won the whole tournament. We went undefeated, beat everybody in the tournament. And at the end, when they're handing out the trophies, we got a trophy for winning the tournament. We also got the sportsmanship award. I had never received a sportsmanship award in my life. I'd actually been, I've got a lot of technical fouls. I had been actually kicked out of several leagues entirely. And if I played soccer, I would have got lots of yellow cards. So I received this sportsmanship award. And I thought about that because partly why I got that award was because it was easy. We were winning. We won everything. We were undefeated. It's easy to be a good sport when you're winning. And I think when it equates back to how we are in churches, it would be easy for us to be in unity. It would be easy for us to be in relationships if we're all the same. It's tougher when you're losing. Paul writes to the Ephesians, and this is the church where people were generally different. He writes to this church, and they were all really different people. He tells them what they must believe about each other. He says, here's what I want you to believe in verses 4-6. He says this, there is one body and one spirit, just as you were called to hope when you were called. There is one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. What he's saying is there are seven things that unify us. There are seven things right off the bat that were said, even though you're different, even though that you guys look alike, even though you dress different, even though you guys have different ages, different culturally, there are seven things that unify you. And this is true today. The first thing he says is there is one body. There's only one church. If you're part of God's people, you are in that one body. No matter where you are, no matter what church you go to, what church you don't go to, there are different congregations around everywhere, but Paul says you are unified because you are in one body. When we talk about the Big C Church and Little C Church, we're talking about the Big C Church, the Church of Jesus Christ. And he says one of the things that bring you together is one body. Secondly, he says there's one Spirit, the Holy Spirit. Regardless of who you are, regardless of how you came to faith, that same Holy Spirit is responsible for it. No matter where it was at, no matter how what it looked like, he says you're unified in that. Paul says you're unified in one spirit. He also says you're unified in one hope. One hope. The hope that we're unified in is the confident expectation that Christ died for me and he's going to prepare a place for me. That one hope is talking about the gospel. And so that very gospel that saved people in the church of Ephesus, that have saved people throughout all these years, who are right now around the world, that same gospel that saved us unifies us. He also says, there is one Lord. There's one Lord. That unifies us. A.W. Tozer gives this illustration about 100 pianos. If you took 100 pianos and you tried to tune them to each other, you tried to tune them back and forth to each other, it's going to be a disaster. You'd never get a perfect pitch to that. But if you took a tuning fork and you tuned each piano to that tuning fork, they would automatically all be in tune with each other. Tozer says we don't become unified by pursuing unity with each other. We become unified by pursuing unity with that one Lord. And when we do that, when we get in tune with that one Lord, we'll be in tune with each other. And so many times we try to have that unity and try to be in sync with each other. He says we're unified by one Lord. We're also unified, Paul says, with one faith. Grace. through Jesus Christ, that one faith that we believe in what Jesus did for us. The gospel joins us together across all barriers because that is what unites us. We also are joined together, Paul says, with one baptism. You know, it doesn't really matter how you were baptized as far as a different style. It doesn't matter. This is beautiful here. That was beautiful today. Was it beautiful? Amen. Man, at the North campus, we set up a hot tub, a portable hot tub. It's a blow-up hot tub, and sometimes it leaks, and sometimes water gets everywhere. The first couple rows we call the splash zone. We hand out garbage bags because you're liable. We get people cannonballing that dude. We're unified in one baptism. We're unified in one baptism because no matter what it looked like, where you're at, if you're in a lake, if you're in a river, I baptized a guy in Northern Ireland in a lake in front of a castle in 30-degree water. I said, what do you want me to say? He said, I don't know, but say it fast. The point is, we were all baptized at one baptism, and what it looked like, that was our starting point. We all had that one starting point of saying, this is where I begin this journey. And Paul says we are unified in that. He also says we're unified by one God and Father of all. He says the source, the very source of all of this, we are unified in that. Paul is saying we are unified in these seven things. That we can find all these other differences, we can find all these other things that are secondary, that don't matter. He says, we're unified in these things. Unity isn't something that we create, something that already exists. God's just waiting for us to put it together. He says, you're unified in me, you just don't know it yet. So Paul asks us to examine our beliefs, because our beliefs, the problem with our beliefs is we have a little messed up belief system. We don't believe all these things because it's easy to lose this idea that we're supposed to love everybody and we're supposed to be in unity because we look differently and act differently. For some people, the problem isn't our beliefs, actually. For some people, it's not. For some people, the problem is we don't act consistently on these beliefs. We go, yeah, I get that. You guys say, I understand that. I get that. I believe that. I believe we're one body. I believe we're one baptism. I believe all that stuff. I'm with you on that. The problem is our behavior doesn't exhibit that. That's me a lot of times. I know we're unified. Here's what Paul says in Ephesians 4, 2, and 3. He says, here's how we're supposed to behave. Always be humble and gentle. That could just be, we could just like go, we can just take the rest of that off there. Always be humble and gentle, he says. Be patient with each other, making allowances for each other's faults because of your love. Make every effort to keep yourself unified, united in the Spirit, binding yourself together with peace. Let's face it. A lot of us have the right theology. Our problem is with the person sitting two rows back. Yeah, everybody starts, yeah, kind of look back over your shoulder. If you think it's you, it's, yeah, it probably is. That's our problem, because our problem is applying theology that we believe right to real people who have real sins, who let us down. That changes our relationships. So we have the right belief, we have the wrong behavior. He says in that verse, he says, be completely humble. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity through the Spirit and a bond of peace. Paul says, hey, you want to know how to get along? Let me just tell you how to get along. Here's a good way to have some good relationships. Always be humble. Be patient. Do things in love. Here's what Paul says it'll take. Paul says it'll take humility. He said it's going to take humility. In the Greeks' day back then, the Greeks saw humility as a weakness. A servant had humility. If someone back there called you humble, it wasn't going to be a compliment. I think we think about that the same way now. When we think about someone who has humility, we think it is a weakness. But there's actually an inner strength in humility. There really is. Paul asks us to pursue humility. Here's what C.S. Lewis said. He said, humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. Last August, I was at Saddleback Church in Southern California, suffering for the Lord. That church holds 4,000 people in the main auditorium. Right outside the auditorium, there's a big, humongous restroom. In the men's restroom, as I was waiting in line, there's big, big lines. There's always bigger lines in the women's restroom, by the way, but in the men's restroom, there's still a line. I was waiting in line in the restroom, and as I finally got inside, there was a guy in the back who was directing traffic. The guy said, hey, I got two open down here. I got one here. I got a sink open over here. The guy said, hey, come on back. I got one here. And you know what happened? It was extremely helpful. This guy said, man, come right here. Come on down. As I got closer to him, a guy behind me tried to joke with this guy out loud. He said, hey, what are you, the potty police? He said, are you on the toilet team? And this guy graciously laughed along. And he said, hey, this is where they needed me. And I'm glad to serve you guys. That's humility. You know, at Celebrate Recovery on Thursday nights, we have a volunteer. He comes each week and he does anything that's needed. If we need him to lead and facilitate a group, he does that. If we need him to help in the kitchen or help set up things, he does that. If we need him to pray with somebody, he does that. At the end of the day, he's the last one to leave. And what he does is he goes around to every restroom and he cleans everything up. He takes the trash out. Outside, there's a bucket where people smoke, and they throw their cigarette butts. They also throw all kind of trash in there. And the very last thing he does for the day is he reaches down that bucket, and he gets out everybody else's trash that's nasty. He doesn't complain. He smiles. He puts it in a trash bag. He throws the trash away to make sure the doors are locked up. He's a high-capacity professional man who does this with dignity. He's so humble that he asked me not to use his name. You want to be better at relationships. You want to be more like what Paul said about being humble. I want to be like this guy. Today, I want to ask you to do something in your bulletin. Who's a great example of humility in your life? Think about that. I want you to write that name down in this blank. Who's a great example of humility? What happens is a lot of times on all these things, we want to write, we'll write Jesus. Because at church, that's always the right answer, right? The pastor has something, that's the right answer. But here's what happens. Sometimes in our life, we can't imagine being like that. We want to be like it. We want to say that. But I say, I can't imagine myself really being like that because I know me. Can you imagine yourself being like somebody who you write in there? That's doable. Today, when Paul says, be humble. I want you to think about what that looks like in your life. And so think about that. You don't have to do it right now, but at some point, write a name down in there of something that exhibits humility in your life. And be like them. It's doable. The second thing that Paul talks about is gentleness. Gentleness. Gentleness refers to how you are in a disposition to other people. Sometimes they even use an analogy of a domesticated animal. Think about a Clydesdale horse pulling a wagon. That horse is powerful. That horse is strong. But it restrains itself for the use of others. That horse didn't lose its power. It is controlling its power. That's what gentleness is. Gentleness is that. Gentleness is not a weakness. It is controlling that weakness or controlling that. Here's a good definition, gentleness. It says, sensitivity of circumstances and kindness of behavior, founded in strength and prompted in love. Gentleness. Our good friend Chuck McCoskey, you might know Chuck McCoskey, he said this, gentleness can help us make a point without making an enemy through gentleness. I taught a ministry class in Kenya. I visited 5 years, so I go to Kenya every few months and teach this ministry class. We teach his classes, and we teach them to be replicatable. We teach them so that other people can redo these classes. So when we do that, there's a lot of rules we have to follow. I'm not big on rules. But I know I have to teach these rules because they say, if you're going to replicate that, how are we going to do this? One of the rules is if someone is late to class, we have to call them out in front of everybody, and they have to explain to us why they were late. It's one of the rules we use. There was a guy who got there exactly on time every morning. We started at 8 a.m. He got there every day on time. On the last day, on a Friday morning, he got there 2 minutes late. I saw him walking up, and I was sick. I was going to totally let it slide. I thought, oh, dude, sneak in, man, sneak in. But the main instructor saw him too and gave me the stink eye. So I had to use the rules. I had to call this guy out. And I said, would you like to explain to the whole class why you're late? The guy was a big giant of a man, powerful, muscular, proud, dignified. And he stood up and he said, I'm very sorry I'm late. I am working. I said, thank you. You can have a seat. I asked a guy after class, what did he mean by I am working? They said, hey, he gets this class, let's go from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. He gets out of these classes and he walks 4 miles to his house. And he spends a few hours in the evening with his family. And to be able to go to these classes right now, he's doing his job all night long. So he works all night and then walks 4 miles to be there in the morning. He made it every day except one. He was 2 minutes late. The guy could have easily stood up and said, hey, man, I worked all night. I've been trying to be here. I've been here every day. Give me a break. But he didn't. What he did was he exhibited gentleness. This big, strong man was gentle. He said, I'm sorry I'm late. I'm working. He sat back down. What it did, it defused the whole situation. Everybody exhaled gentleness. Who's a great example of gentleness in your life? Who is somebody that always is gentle? You should write their name in that blank. When you say, what's it look like to be gentle? Go, it looks like that. And I can do that. The next thing that Paul talks about is patience. Patience is a way of really putting up with people in difficult or aggravating situations. Patience is not simply the ability to wait. It's how we behave while we're waiting. We're not just trying to wait somebody out. We're saying, hey, it's how we act, how we behave while we're waiting. James 1:9 says this. Understand this, my dear brothers and sisters. You must be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to get angry. Be patient. Paul says, if you want to get along with people, if you want to have this connection with people, you want to get relationships better, you have to be patient. My dad was not a good example of patience. He couldn't sit still and be quiet if things weren't going well. We were in the boat fishing, and the wind started to blow us around. My dad would blow a gasket. He would start getting so upset and so angry at little things like that. If he was watching TV, the Cubs, or IU, and the cable glitched, my dad was not patient. My dad would make up cuss words. I'd say, man, come on, Dad. That ain't even got no vowels in it, man. That ain't even a word, man. My dad had lots and lots of great, wonderful qualities. Patience was not one of them. But I had an art teacher in high school. Mr. Sondergren. He was fastidious. He was proper. He dressed very crisp khakis and a very crisp shirt. He was clean cut. I was not. I wore old jeans. I wore grubby t-shirts. I had long hair. I had my senior picture taken with a Jaws shirt on. We were very different, but we had one thing that united us. Art. I loved to draw. I loved to paint. I was difficult in his class. I made it very hard for him to teach. I was disruptive. I did dumb things to get attention. But he stayed patient with me. He never lost his cool. We never blew up. What he was he was quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to get angry. And this diffused the situation always. He would correct me, he would discipline me, but he also would encourage me and be patient with me. That's who I'd write on that. I can't be as patient as Jesus is because, man, Jesus is patient with me. He's patient. But I think, I don't know if I could do that, but you know what? I could do this. I could be patient like Mr. Sondergren. Paul says the last thing we need to do is to do everything in love. To do it in love. He says there are going to be tensions. There are going to be conflicts. And sometimes we got to just put up with each other. But he says when you do this, do it in love. My friend Amy Rowe exemplifies love. She's the best example I can think of. Amy just simply loves people in all situations, plainly, openly, and honestly. She loves completely. She loves wonderfully. People know that she loves them. She gives people her full attention. I've seen Amy in difficult situations, whether it be at the crossing where she was or just in life, and I've seen her be in tough situations. We have to endure people. And she didn't endure them. She loved them through it. Amy puts up with me even when I'm difficult and when I'm not a great friend in return. Verse 2 concludes like this. Make allowances for each other's faults because of your love. And Amy exemplifies that for me. Who does that for you? Who are you going to put? Who's the person that exemplifies love for you? Who's the person that you're going to write in there and say, you know what? I want to be that kind of love. I can do that. This is what happens when we do these things and we have our right beliefs and our right behaviors in sync. We are humble. We are gentle. We are patient. And we do things in love. See, what happens is Paul calls us not to do these things in a dream world. He calls us to do things in a real world with real people like me who are going to require every ounce of gentleness, humility, and patience and love to deal with people like me and like you. So we want this from other people. We want people to be patient and humble and gentle with us. We want people to love us. And yet, we're not sure about that behavior for other people. This can only happen through Jesus. It can only happen because we've proven on our own that we don't do well with this. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said this, "For Jesus Christ alone is our unity. He is our peace. Through him alone do we have access to one another. We have joy in one another and fellowship with one another." That's our unity. That's the one thing that we can count on in our life. All the things that are different, we can count on that one thing. It's through Jesus we can have these things. A TV image, this TV right here, the image is made up of pixels, tiny little pixels of color. Each pixel is just a dot. There's a lot of dots that are in there. Pixel density, the number of pixels that are compressed in there, they make up the display. And the more pixels that go in there, the better the resolution. The better the resolution, the more detailed the image. The more detailed the image, the more sharper the view. And the sharper view gives us the clearest picture. For me, living in high definition, how do I live in high definition? High definition means having as many good relationships that are different and diverse packed together. And then I get a really clear, great picture of life. Living in high definition, where I take all these relationships, these are diverse relationships, and I do things and I develop these and I make them healthy by being gentle and humble and patient and loving. High definition. I want to live in high definition where I have so many people, so many things, pixels that are jammed together that my life is high definition. When I look out and I see my life, it's in high definition. So where do we start? This is the tough part. Where do we start at? We start by saying this. Who do we need to mend a relationship with? What relationships are broken? What relationships would be affected well if I displayed humility, if I displayed gentleness, if I displayed patience and love? What relationships need to be mended? The second is, where do you need to start? Who do you need to start a relationship with? Who is someone that you say, man, I want to add more pixels in my life? We believe we're better together. Who is it that I want to add and start relationships with? Another way to start is say this, are all of your relationships safe and easy? Are they all safe and easy? Do you only try to begin relationships with people who are going to be easy? I got a little hint for you. Not everybody had a relationship with you because you're easy. Are they all safe and easy? Are you taking the comfortable route? What do you fear in new relationships? If you want to add to your life, if you want to live in living color and in full, vibrant, high definition, what do you fear about adding new relationships? What do you fear about that? And then lastly, do most of your relationships look like you? Think about your sphere of influence, your sphere of friends. Do most of them look just like you? If they do, that's like having a one-meat meatball. You're missing out on so many flavors. They say it takes two to make a thing go right. It takes two to make it out of sight. If you don't add to your sphere of relationships, you're going to miss out. A lot of wonderful, unique flavors. Today, I have more wonderfully diverse relationships than I've had in my whole life. You know, I've got friends in many states. I have friends in Africa, in China, in Haiti, in Guatemala, in Honduras, in Northern Ireland. But some of the people that have changed my life the very most, I have met in the last 10 months here in Kokomo, Indiana. People who are real, people who are transparent, people who are not okay, so they're okay with my not okay, and they let me in. People who are way more resourced than me. People who are less resourced than me. People live in neighborhoods that I could never dream of living in. People who live in parking garages. People who are culturally different. People who are older than me. People who are younger than me. People who have criminal backgrounds. People who are socially different. People who are spiritually different. People who love me just as I am. People who are patient with me. People who show humility to me. People who show gentleness to me. People who show love to me. Because, man, I ain't easy to love all the time. I'm not. But because of these relationships, my life has become more high definition. It has. My worldview is sharper. My worldview is clearer. I feel like now I'm seeing the world a little more like Jesus does. Because I've added these relationships. It doesn't mean I always act like Jesus. But I am in pursuit of Jesus. Man, adding these relationships, saying we weren't made to do this together. I am not supposed to be isolated. I need to do this with other people. When I do that, I see Jesus in them. And then I become more like him. I'm going to close with these three thoughts. The way that you live has nothing to do with how you were saved. It doesn't. Ephesians 2, 8 and 10 says this. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no man may boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. You were saved by grace alone. How you walk has nothing to do with how you were saved. That's a start. You can't be humble enough. You can't be gentle enough. You can't be patient enough. You can't love enough. You were saved by grace alone. If you haven't accepted that gift of grace, there's not going to be any grace. Secondly, the way we walk is seen in how we treat others. Paul says, therefore, I, a prisoner for serving the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of your calling, for you have been called by God. Always be humble. Be gentle, be patient with each other, making allowances for each other's faults because of your love. Make every effort to keep yourself united in the Spirit, binding yourself together with peace. Paul says, look at these qualities. The way we walk is how we treat others. The qualities he lists right there, he says it's humility, it's gentleness, it's patience, it's bearing with one another, and it's loving people. If how we walk is seen in how we treat others and how our relationships are. People are watching that. They're watching our walk. It's pretty simple. When you put other people first, when you say they're the main thing, that their interests are higher than my interest, people around you go first. People get the best portion. People that you do life with, hang out with. They get first. This isn't easy. It isn't easy. But the way we walk is seen in how we treat others. And lastly, the way we walk is up to you. We get to decide this. We get to decide how we are with other people. We get to decide with our relationships. We get to decide how we connect with people. Let me tell you, we were not made to do this alone. Kids and grandkids. I have both. I have grandkids. When I see them playing well together, when I see kids cooperating, when I see kids being kind, when I see kids loving each other, man, makes me happy. That's how God sees it. When he sees us doing that, you think we could give God a break and let him exhale and just sit back in the chair for a minute? That's what I do. When the kids are playing well, I can sit on the porch swing and just be for a minute. I like to believe that God can do that when he sees us playing well together in good relationships. I think that God can relax in that. Ephesians 4, 30 through 32 says this. This is at the very, we started at the first verse, we're going to go to the very end verse. Paul says, get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, harsh words, and slander, as well as types of evil behavior. Instead, be kind to each other, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, just as God through Christ has forgiven you. God's playbook. This series said God's playbook. This is God's plan. Here's how we do it. Here's how that we get along well together. We were not meant to do this alone. We were meant to be together. God doesn't just give us his promises. He gives us each other. And we can, together, be more like him. I'm going to close with this blessing. May you think the right things, biblical things about relationships. May you bring your actions in line with what is true and right. Your behaviors, what is true and right. Not through your power, but through the power of Jesus Christ. May you live lives worthy of your calling. And may you do this in love.